Mecca, Saturday, June 14th, 2014. Hey, Mech Geeks, it's Tom for your MechCast, the show for Mech Geeks by Mech Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is a show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MechCast. Well, I think it's safe to say we've got a metric ton load. That's what I'm going to call it, a ton load of stuff to talk about. Coming off WWDC, lots of stuff happening. We've got more news and information about what's going on with iOS 8 and OS 10 Yosemite. We're starting to find out some of the new features as developers get in and explore some of the things that weren't shown off at WWDC. So we're going to talk about that. We also got rumors of the next generation products, iWatch, iPhone, you know, all that good stuff that we've been talking about for a while. And Apple's doing a little more policing on the App Store, which I think is a good thing. We've got that and a bunch more stories for you. Also got some great feedback from you on WWDC, some information about SSD upgrades and what to do if your hard drive suddenly goes missing. There's an interesting story there, and we're going to get to it later in the show, so stay tuned for that. Before we get into everything, though, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show's sponsors, and that is Sanebox. You know, I signed up for Sanebox, and I have to tell you, I can't imagine how I lived without it. If you're like me, you get too much email, right? We all get tons of email, and if you're in that kind of situation, Sanebox is definitely for you, because what it does is it analyzes and it looks at your email and it looks at not just your email, but how you use and interact with your email, and moves unimportant emails out of your inbox. It automatically cleans up your inbox and just leaves the most important messages, the things that you want to get to right there, and then shuffles everything off so that you can go back later and review, when you have more time, the less important stuff, right? And it does this in any email provider, any email client, or on any device that you like. Sounds amazing, right? And it actually is. So how does it know what's important? Well, what it does is it analyzes your behavior. So it watches you as you open your email. It looks at what you respond to, how quickly you respond to it, how often. And then it starts to get a profile and determine the importance of incoming emails without having to look at any of the content or the headers. It's not in there reading through your emails. It's looking at more the behavior. And then what it can do is it can take that information and then just move things off into some other folders. So there's different kinds of folders you can set up and subscribe to. Things like Sane News. And that would be all of the newsletters that we sign up for. You know, a lot of us sign up for those. We want to get that information, but we don't need it cluttering up our inbox. Or how about all of those order receipts and sort of bulk emails you get? They have a Sane Bulk folder that can shuffle all that stuff on off into. And then the stuff that's a little bit less important, that shows up in the Sane Later folder. And if something's more important, all you have to do to train Sanebox is actually just move it to the correct folder. So if it ends up in the wrong place, just move it to the right place, and boom, it'll relearn that behavior and it'll start to adapt. It's really pretty incredible. And they're constantly adding new features. One of my favorite new ones is they have now a Sane Not Spam folder. How many times have you had that situation where someone says, did you check your spam folder? Because you're like, I didn't get that email. Where is it? Well, Sanebox is going to watch for those kinds of things and identify email that maybe shouldn't have went to the spam folder, but it could be spam. You're not really sure. It'll show up in there. And I've actually now caught quite a few messages in my Sane Not Spam folder. There's a ton of other features, too many to mention. You can get information on their website, but they have things like one click on subscriber. They have this cool feature for snoozing emails. So if it's something you want to get to a day later or 3 days later, you can set up a behavior for that. You can have attachments automatically moved into file storage services like Dropbox. It's really incredible. And best of all, you can try it out for free and get a $10 credit simply by going to sanebox.com/MacCast. So you can get all the details and your deal and your free trial over at sanebox.com/MacCast. Awesome stuff, and a big thank you to Sanebox for their support of the MacCast. So here we are, we're coming off WWDC week, the Worldwide Developer Conference for Apple, and developers have now had their hands on iOS 8 and OS 10 Yosemite for a little bit. They're starting to dig in, they're starting to dive in, get into some of those cool features, and this past week we saw a lot more information coming out. So I thought I'd talk about some of the interesting features and things that I've seen over the past week, and I've just kind of grouped everything into different sorts of categories. So Photos in iOS 8 has some interesting stuff that Apple did not show to us during the keynote. Specifically, it has now the ability, apparently, to have favorites, so you can tag photos as your favorites, and they'll automatically go into a favorite album, and it also has the ability to hide photos. I think this seems to work a little bit like hiding photos in iPhoto on the Mac. Basically, hidden items are not visible in the Moments, Collections, and Years view. I guess it's a little bit different on iOS because when you go into the album, you'll actually see the hidden photos, probably because there wasn't an easy way to sort of toggle that like you have on the desktop, but similar kind of behavior. So when you're flipping through your Moments and Collections and Years and just browsing through, you're not going to see all of your photos. And I think that's a good feature. It's the kind of thing where all of us take photos and you have kind of like the ones that you really like in a set, and then you have the ones that are like, those are okay, but I don't need to see them all the time. And I think this is part of the whole thing, because Apple's going to allow you with the iCloud photo library to have access to all your photos, it'll make it easier to sort of be able to browse and flip through your photo library. So I thought that was pretty cool. You're also going to have albums automatically set up based on the types of photos, which I think can be really helpful, because now we know iOS 8 is going to have the features you can take panoramas, you can take time-lapse photos, you got your videos in there, and you want to be able to better organize that. It'll automatically group those things into kind of some smart albums and for you. And you're also going to have albums based on third-party editing apps. So if you take a photo, you take it off into a third-party app and do some editing on it, those will be gathered together. So you can see, for example, all the stuff you edited with Snapseed, I would imagine, which I think will be also really helpful. And you can then order your albums in any order you like, so you can kind of reprioritize stuff. I'm hoping, although I didn't read, hopefully you'll have the ability to kind of turn on and off some of these photos too. So if you don't find some of them very useful, or these sort of auto-generated albums, turn those off in case you don't really need them. And then another thing, not directly related to the Photos app, but it looks like in the Notes application, you're now going to have access to your photos and you'll be able to put photos into Notes. I'm not really sure how useful that one's going to be for myself. I don't use Notes too frequently. I tend to use other applications for my note-taking. But for those of you who are heavy Notes users, that's a nice little addition. We found out a little bit more about the new AirDrop functionality. We're now going to have the ability to do AirDrop not only between Macs and between iOS devices. So we had it where you could go Mac to Mac, you could go iOS device to iOS device, but you never had the ability to go between an iOS device and a Mac. That's changing in iOS 8. And it looks like the way it's going to work is that owners who are logged into their iCloud accounts, the same iCloud account on an iOS 8 device and in OS 10 Yosemite on the computer, you're going to be able to share files back and forth, and you're not going to have to do the little pop-up consent thing. So you'll be able to just drop things back and forth, which should save some time. And it knows that, you know, hey, this is your account. It's the same account. So that's more of that seamless integration, the what Apple is calling continuity between devices, right? Because if I want to send something from my Mac to my iPad or my iPad to my Mac, I don't need to sort of, you know, say, yes, I want to receive that file. I would assume it's still going to work if you're sending to another person. It's going to pop up and say, hey, Adam's trying to send you a file over AirDrop. Do you accept? And it's looking like AirDrop, the new version of AirDrop that's in Yosemite, is entirely different, possibly completely rewritten from the version that we have in OS X Mavericks, because it looks like it's incompatible with the current version. So you can't send, apparently, from OS X Yosemite to Mavericks using the new AirDrop functionality. But what Yosemite does seem to provide, I guess, is an option for legacy AirDrops, and that will work for legacy AirDrop rather, and that'll work with Macs running Mavericks and older. So if you need to send an older file, I think it would just function a little bit differently. I don't know if it's a separate app. It wasn't really clear from the piece that I was reading, but you will have some kind of backwards compatibility. It's just not going to be the same kind of interface, or it sounds like the experience is going to be a little bit different. And one nice way it's going to be a little bit different when you're sending from iOS to Mac is that, unlike, you know, now with the AirDrop, you have to have, going Mac to Mac, you each have to have the Finder open and you have to be in that special little AirDrop folder. It's looking like if you're going from iOS to Mac, you're actually able to send with AirDrop to the desktop with or without the Finder window active and in AirDrop mode. So you'll be able to send without having to have that actually active, which is going to be really nice. couple of little new nice items that were discovered in Safari: credit card scanning. So if you're on a website, you're doing an e-commerce purchase, and you need to punch in your credit card information, kind of like you can with Apple's gift cards now, you'll be able to take your credit card, hold it up to your EyeSight camera, and it will automatically read and input the number into the site. So no more having to hand key that in. It's going to be interesting to see how that works, but that's going to be a nice time-saving feature. Of course, you could always put your credit card numbers into the iCloud keychain and have them autofill in Safari. That's something I don't like to do. I actually don't like to put my credit cards into the keychain, nor into even something like 1Password. So I think I'm going to really like this new credit card scanning feature. Not having to type those long numbers in is always a good thing. And Safari, it looks like it now also includes a really neat option for when you want to have a desktop version of a site load rather than the mobile version. I would assume this is on Safari for mobile. And what you'll be able to do is simply request the desktop version of a site up front. It's like a built-in option, so you don't have to go find their little link somewhere to actually force it to give you the full desktop version if that's the experience you want. So that's going to be another really nice feature. Maps. There was a lot of information coming out about Maps. Maps was something that really didn't get featured at WWDC during the keynote. There were no sort of key new mapping features mentioned, although we had heard a lot of rumors in the build-up to WWDC, things like improved data in general. Apple didn't talk about that. Indoor mapping features were rumored to be coming. Also, public transit directions, even going so far as having some rumors that there might be new augmented reality modes for maps. And none of that stuff made its way into the keynote. There was a session slide that surfaced during the event that did show a bus icon in one of the screenshots, and it was actually pulled down or removed from the slide later by Apple after it was discovered by some of the blogs, which is a pretty good sign that Apple had something in there that they were working on, and probably indicates that Apple does plan to bring transit directions at some point back into Maps. A lot of people are really looking forward to that. We had heard that there were several features of Maps that had been pushed back, that Apple was sort of scrambling to get things done in the build-up to WWDC, and just the mapping stuff wasn't coming together. And then this week, TechCrunch reported that there were actually a number of issues, including not just technical ones, apparently, that there was some office politicking going on, and that led to some delays. Also, some of the mapping engineers actually left, were pulled into other projects, things like that, and that sort of slowed things down. These are sort of the typical things we hear about why Apple has to delay certain features and functionality. But we'll have to see if Apple can get that done for the final release of iOS 8 and macOS 10, or I keep saying macOS 10 Yosemite, and somebody pointed out very rightly that Apple has dropped the Mac from the operating system. So I'm going to try and get better about this, but hopefully some of the mapping features we've been hearing about will service in the release of OS 10 Yosemite and iOS 8. As far as what those features might be, I think the rumors of Apple just improving the data in general, also bringing in transit directions, and I would hope taking some of the acquisitions that they made last year and integrating some of those features. So a lot more of the place information and retail information, and really bolstering up location data and stuff like that. Not location data in terms of where you are, but about the different places that we visit and we go to, and we want to get information about. Apple acquired a bunch of companies that aggregated data and technology and information, and really could be used to build up the database of sort of what can be presented when you're interacting with Maps. And one big area that Apple is reportedly working on and expanding into is this concept of generating indoor maps for different locations. So you imagine you go to a museum, or you go to the mall or the grocery store even, and it can help guide you and direct you to the places where you need to get to within buildings and things like that. Google's been working on systems like this using human beings. The report here is that Apple is going to use their iBeacon technology, which is being deployed into retail spaces, to use iOS devices in your phone and where you go to sort of help map out and verify indoor maps for different locations and places and stuff like that. Now, Obviously, there's somewhat of a privacy concern there, but keep in mind iBeacon technology and using apps with iBeacons, it's all an opt-in system. So you actually have to opt in to be able to be tracked by iBeacon. So it's a little bit better than some of the other systems that are out there, like using Wi-Fi. We're going to talk about that a little bit later. Using Wi-Fi to just track people. There's a new feature in iOS 8 that's going to make it harder for retailers to track you anonymously using your Wi-Fi data. But obviously, Apple is hoping that users will be willing to share their data and information, and they added new M7 processor and iPhone motion sensor data to the core location API. So that's something that developers could use within their apps and start using those functionalities of the iPhone, the hardware, to start sending this data and not putting a big drain on the iPhone, and they can use it to collect information for doing indoor location detection and that sort of stuff. And it's actually already in use, apparently, in a couple of locations in San Francisco, the San Francisco California Academy of Arts, the Westfield Center in San Francisco, and at the San Jose Airport. And so they're building these indoor mapping systems that can help give information like, for example, what floor you're on, or it can direct a user to different points of interest or information. And I would imagine in the case of museums and things like that, you can even have data and information come up as you approach a display, something like that. So not even having to pull your phone out, you could bring information right up probably on the lock screen about maybe a painting or an exhibit that you're looking at, which could be very, very helpful and useful. And another helpful and useful bit of technology that actually exists, I think, in other devices, Google phones and things like that, is the ability to mark the parking location, where you parked, right? This is something we struggle with all the time. It's like, where did I park? It would be great if your phone would just know where you parked, right? Because they can tell when you sort of driven one place and stopped one place and maybe automatically mark something. Well, it looks like iOS 8 might be getting that functionality as well. In one of the beta builds, someone noticed that there's actually some parking pin assets that could be used to help locate where your car was. So you can open up the map, you'll see a special little parking pin right where you parked, and you'll be able to get back there quickly and easily. So looks like there are some mapping updates planned. Apple hasn't just tipped their hand with any of that yet, but we're getting some great information out from developers and from some of the earlier beta builds, kind of indicating what we might expect this fall. The music application has a couple little nice updates. You can now swipe to delete albums, so you can kind of clean up your library a little bit easier. And you'll also be able to add songs to playlists from other playlists. Frankly, I didn't even know you couldn't do that right now, but I could see how that would be a really nice feature. You know, you want to kind of mix and combine playlists or share songs from one playlist to another. You're going to be able to do that in iOS 8. There's some really nice accessibility enhancements and updates. We'll probably have to get Josh DeLionCourt on a future episode. We'll probably get him out. We usually get Josh over here talking about accessibility and all the new accessibility features when the new operating system launches. So maybe in the fall, we'll get him to come back on and run us through all the features. But some we're hearing about now, there's going to be a new grayscale mode. Also, improvements to the zoom with new options to do things like follow focus, to detach the zoom controls. And this one I thought would be really nice, to leave the keyboard unzoomed. So you don't have to have everything zoomed when you're in the zoom mode. You can leave the keyboard zoomed out and just browse around, find the stuff that you want in the area you want to interact with. So I think that's going to be really helpful. There's also going to be new options for a lens mode, either windowed or in full screen. And also you can adjust the effect inside your lens. You can have it grayscale, inverted, or just inverted. So that's some of that high contrast stuff that can help with visual impairments. And then something, I'm curious to hear how this works. There's going to be a new speak screen feature. You'll be able to do a two-finger swipe gesture and trigger a function that's going to speak the entire contents of your screen automatically. So I don't know if that's going to help with maybe apps that haven't been fully supported in terms of accessibility. Again, we're going to have to get some more information and details on that. If you happen to know what the difference between just like a screen reader and a speak screen function is, and if you could let us know about it, please shoot us an audio comment or send us an email over at mattcast@gmail.com. And Apple has said, you know, that they're pretty big on consumer privacy. And we heard about some really nice new privacy features in iOS 8 and OS 10 Yosemite. Now, iOS 8, as I mentioned earlier, is going to randomize your MAC address, the media access control address on your device. And that's a unique number in each device for when you connect to the network, the MAC address, for those who aren't familiar with that term. And what's been going on is mobile Wi-Fi hotspots at different retailers can use that to kind of track maybe which stores you've been in. So imagine that you're connecting to Starbucks Wi-Fi. They could gather that MAC address and see that, oh, this device was at this Starbucks this day, and it was at that Starbucks the next day, and when it comes back to this Starbucks every week. Now, I'm not sure they can really tie that to specific information, like knowing this is Adam's iPad, but they have been gathering up that information. Reportedly, this new feature would sort of stop them from being able to do that, because as you're scanning for and looking for Wi-Fi connections, it's going to do a random MAC address, and it's not until you choose to actually connect to the network that it's going to have to actually pass along the real thing. And somebody also rightly pointed out, though, that it could force more retailers to move to iBeacons as their preferred tracking system for sort of tracking customers and data and information. But once again, I think that's kind of a better system, because iBeacons are completely opt-in. So you'd have to have iBeacons turned on. You'd have to probably have the app from whatever store you're interacting with, and you have to opt in to share your information via iBeacon, so a little bit more transparent in terms of what's going on there. There's also some nice new functionality with the location data. So if you set up so that your app is allowed to use location information to use the GPS, you now have a new while using option. And if you enable this option, it means that it's only going to share your location data when the application is in use, when it's in active use. And also, they're going to give you a pop-up now, apparently, asking permission when an app attempts to use your location in the background. So it's not just going to be you're going to have to drill into the settings and go check the app list and see which apps have recently requested location information. It's actually going to ask you, hopefully just the first time an app tries to access location from the background, do you want to allow this app to continue to do that? And you'll be given an option to say yes or no. So that's going to be really nice, having the ability to know exactly what's going on with your location data information. And then I think I mentioned this in the past MacCast, but I do want to point it out again. Apple is adding DuckDuckGo as an alternative search engine in Safari. That's a search engine that promises not to track any of your searches or your internet history. So if you use Google right now, Google pays attention and actually records all the different searches you do. It records a history of your internet searches and things like that. DuckDuckGo doesn't gather or use any of that information. And so if you're concerned about privacy and your search, that's going to be a really nice option inside Safari. Now, not directly related to iOS, but after an NPR report, Apple has said that it is going to work to provide end-to-end email encryption outside of iCloud. This was something that came up, and I had no idea it was even going on. I guess I never assumed, unless I actually wanted to use a technology like PGP or something like that to encrypt my emails, I've never assumed that my email is actually encrypted. But apparently, there's a new standard or a new technology that can be implemented to encrypt email as it travels between different email providers. And Apple currently, with iCloud, if you're sending from one iCloud user to another iCloud user, your email is actually encrypted as it's in transmission between the two accounts. But if you're going to an outside service, so if you're sending from iCloud to, say, a Google account or a Yahoo account, that email is currently not encrypted. But services like Yahoo and Google have implemented this new technology that actually encrypts all your email as it's traveling between different locations. And it's called Start TLS. It's the Start TLS extension, and it allows for the encryption of text connections between providers. So Gmail, Yahoo Mail, they've already implemented support for this standard. sounding like Apple's going to finally jump on board and also implement that for iCloud users. So better protection for your email. You're not going to be able to have people snooping in on that stuff as it's moving around between servers and things like that. So I think that's a good thing. Just a few more odds and ends with regards to some of the new features in iOS 8 and Mac OS 10 Yosemite. See, I just did it again. In OS 10 Yosemite, messages, you're now going to be able to batch save or batch delete attachments because of that new details view they have. So you'll be able to hold down on a single image in that detail view, and there's a more option apparently. You can select multiple attachments, and then you can save them all to your camera roll at once or delete all of them. So if you've been in a long thread and there's been a lot of photos going back and forth and you either want to clear those out or save all of them, that's going to make that process a lot quicker. Something I'm very excited about within Mail, apparently inside Mail, you can now get notifications per thread. So rather than having to be notified for every mail that comes in, under the More tab, you're going to have the option to actually receive push notifications whenever a reply is sent to just a specific thread. So if you have an email thread going on, something that you want to stay on top of, you'll be able to set that up and only get notifications for that. And then related to some of the new Notification Center widget technology, we mentioned that third parties are going to be able to tap into that to add controls and information inside the Notification Center. Philips has already said that they are going to produce a, or actually have already showed off, rather, a functionality where they have a widget that'll allow you to control your Hue bulbs, and they posted that on Twitter. So we already see developers and companies getting excited about a lot of the new extension technology that allows them to tap deeper into core functionality inside Mac OS X. So I think that's really good to see. It's really good to see how excited people are getting about. I think I already mentioned with the third-party keyboards, a lot of the third-party keyboard apps are already tapping into the ability to do that. And I think that sort of excitement in the development community is probably the biggest thing coming off of WWDC, is just everybody is really jazzed about where Apple's going with the platform, how they're opening it up. And I think it's really important that they took the time to be able to open it up in really controlled ways that I think are going to help Apple keep a handle on the robustness of the operating system and the user experience. They're really striking that balance with being able to open things up, but still knowing that they can control what's happening. They've got apps in little sandboxes, so you're not having one app doing a bunch of nefarious things and other apps and crashing the system and things like that. These are some of the problems that we have seen on some of the other platforms. So I know a lot of people have been pointing out, hey, Apple's copying a lot of features from, say, Android or from Windows Phone or just these other devices. And that's true because these are all good pieces of functionality. Users of iOS devices have been wanting these things. That's why we have a huge jailbreak community that wants to, you know, add in all that functionality and rest a little bit more control of the operating system. But, you know, Apple held back and said, you know, what's really important is that user experience, making sure that when you pick up an iPhone, you're able to do what you want to do. And it's not, you know, you don't have some rogue process off draining your battery life, or worse yet, messing with your files in ways you don't want them to be messed with. And so they've now got to a point, they've matured the software enough that we can start to get some of these features, but get them in a really good way, a way that, you know, protects our data, protects our privacy, and just creates a better user experience. So I was very, very excited with everything coming off WWDC. As far as what's next, we're starting to hear, you know, some inklings of what the next features and new stuff we might get as Apple starts to develop, I guess, iOS 9 and OS 10, who knows what location in California they're going to pick. Options in Control Center and lock screen extensions. So, you know, Apple is said, we now have these extensions. You can tap into these parts of the operating system. Now people are fully expecting that Apple's going to expand that control into some other areas. And one developer actually already discovered some hints that Apple might have been thinking about having extensions inside Control Center. The ability to, what he found was that there's a way to turn on a function where you can toggle on and off some of the options that are on control center. So you could take away things like the Wi-Fi button or the Bluetooth toggle or the personal hotspot. And in looking at that, it seems like, well, if you're taking those away, you might want to replace them with some other things. So maybe Apple's thinking at some point third-party developers would be able to add buttons and options into the control center. Also, the ability to have extensions on the lock screen. So maybe we can get widgets showing up not only in the notification center, but maybe even on the lock screen at some point. That's something, again, Android phones have had for quite a while. I don't know if they can show up on the lock screen, but at least, you know, on the desktop or the launcher, things like that. But could be interesting to be able to actually add additional features and functionality to your lock screen. So when you pick up your phone, you can get data and information that's not just, you know, within Apple's own applications and things like that. And while we're talking about Control Center, there are some hints, it looks like, in OS X Yosemite that Apple may be looking to bring Control Center to the desktop. This was actually something that was rumored about. It was rumored Apple was working on it in early March, and I think we even saw some screenshots at one point that some of the early March builds had Control Center built into it, but it wasn't seen at WWDC. But some developers now have located a number of different strings inside the first Yosemite builds that seem to confirm that Apple's at least been testing a version of Control Center for the desktop. It's in essence a little panel that slides out from the left side of the screen with all of your different kind of notification centers and controls. And so if Apple's going to bring that to the desktop, I think that's another indicator that it would make sense at some point for Apple to provide an extension for third-party apps and developers to put things into the control center. So what do you think about that? I think you know, there could be some interesting things there if Apple's willing to bring that to the desktop and then also open it up to third-party extensions. And then the last sort of thing for the future, we had heard about prior to WWDC that there might be a split-screen iPad feature shown off, so you could actually have two applications side by side. It was rumored it was going to be iPad only and possibly iPad Air only, just the larger screens, and also only function in landscape mode. Well, developer Stephen Trofton-Smith has since located some strings inside iOS 8 that seem to confirm that Apple has at least been considering the feature, and he was even able to hack together a little example. Now, it was a little kludgy and a little quirky, but he was able to show not just side-by-side options, but also three-quarter and quarter options. So you could have three-quarters of the screen show one app and one-quarter show another, or vice versa, and also do the split-screen 50-50 sort of thing. So, you know, on that feature, this is one I've been talking about. I don't know how useful I would particularly find that on my iPads. I know a lot of people think that, like, this is going to be a huge thing for productivity, but just having, you know, an app sort of crammed into that little tiny space, I don't think is going to make me all that more productive. But I'd be willing to be proven wrong. I've gotten kind of used to the whole fast app switching sort of model, jumping between one app and another, and it doesn't really bother me too much. And I just know that some other devices on the market, I think most notably the Microsoft Surface, I think has that ability to do side-by-side applications. I think they even did some ads sort of touting that as, you know, how they could one-up the iPad. And I'm really curious if you have one of those devices. I'm trying to find somebody who really relies on that feature day-to-day and says, like, this, I need to have this feature on my tablet because it allows me to be so much more productive. And, you know, again, I'm willing to be proven wrong. I just think that it's one of those features that'll get implemented at some point. I think it probably is coming to the iPad, but I think it's also one of those features that's going to be in there and really not used by a whole lot of people. You know, it's going to sort of serve a small percentage of the market. And typically Apple tries to err on the side of, you know, what I would call almost like the 80% rule. You know, they want to target features that 80% of the people are going to use sort of all the time. And I just don't see this one as being that. But it is rumored to be out there, and we might be seeing it come to iOS at some point. I don't know if it'll make it into iOS 8, but maybe by iOS 9. There's some predictions out this past week that the iWatch is going to be big, and I don't mean in size, I actually mean in sales. You know, it's got to fit on your wrist at the end of the day, right? But UBS research believes that the iWatch could sell 21 million units in its first year of sales in fiscal 2015, and then could follow up with another 36 million units sold in the following year. In looking at that, that's basically just as successful as Apple had been with the iPad. And for further comparison, Apple's first iPhone only moved 5.4 million units in its first year. And I don't think anyone would argue that the iPhone wasn't a successful product that first year. What the big difference might be is that the price point's going to be a little bit lower, although they're saying $300 US is what they assumed in this study, and that that would give Apple a 25% profit margin. I think that's pretty pricey for a smartwatch, but maybe I'm wrong. I guess that's about what the Galaxy Gears are selling for, right? Somewhere in that price range. Maybe they've come down a little bit since they were launched. But they're thinking that because of the price point, and also because the product would appeal to a broader consumer audience, that it's going to have a really successful launch in terms of sales. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because you're not talking about just selling a device to tech geeks. You've got the whole fitness industry and people who are into fitness and want to track those sorts of things. You've got just fashion people who are into fashion. It's going to be obviously an iconic, or I guess not, could obviously be a iconic fashion accessory, and anybody who just wants connected devices. So there's kind of a larger core audience right when the product launches that it would appeal to. And most really do feel that the iWatch is going to be more than just a watch. It's going to be more than just a health tracker. It's going to do a lot of different functions and have a lot of integration with our devices and our lives and things like that. So I think that 21 million units we might find may even be conservative in the first year. As far as when that will happen, it's still looking like the iWatch event is going to happen sometime in the fall, and that the launch sales of the device will happen sometime around the October timeframe. And you know, we're going to keep repeating that over and over again. It's seeming like all of Apple's new products are being announced and released sometime in the fall. October is very likely the target time frame for everything to kind of come down and when we actually get the actual information. Of course, another item that's going to be part of that fall October lineup is going to be the iPhone 6, and those rumors are not slowing down one bit. The latest are that the iPhone 6 is going to have NFC, near field communication. We've been hearing that one before, but it's getting a little bit stronger now. We're also hearing some inklings that it could have wireless charging along with improved LTE support. I recently learned the difference from some of my talking about NFC and the chip and pin technology that's used in other parts of the world, about the difference between those two things. And I just want to throw out that I had been kind of sort of combining those two things together, but they're really different. NFC is the kind of system where you just wave your card or your device over a unit or a tracker or receiver, whatever you want to call it, and it picks up the signal and does a transaction. So those NFC systems are being used for kind of micropayments, or if you're paying to get on a transit system or something like that, you might use NFC. Chip and pin, on the other hand, is a replacement for the credit card system like we have here in the States, which we call swipe and sign, where you swipe the little magnetic strip, you sign it. Over in other parts of the world, they have a little chip that's actually on the card. The card still goes into a reader. It physically makes a connection with the chip, and then you enter a PIN code to complete your transaction. And that's generally for transactions of a little bit higher dollar amount. Although, I think I'd also heard that some of you said you could use the chip systems for purchases, smaller purchases under certain dollar amounts without actually having to enter in the PIN number. That's sort of like we have here in the States. You can now do some swiping transactions under certain dollar amounts and not actually have to sign for that sort of thing. But so NFC would be that technology where you would more just wave over a reader and then make some sort of payment. And the NFC feature is said to be dependent on Apple's new mobile payment system. And this is where the whole story kind of throws me off a little bit, because I really think, and Apple's executives have even commented, that you really don't need NFC technology to complete a mobile payment transaction. Apple's proved that in their retail stores. I can make a mobile transaction just using my iTunes ID and my iTunes account. I can scan the item in at the Apple retail store, and I can pay for it and walk out without having to do that sort of thing. And I think you combine that with some of the iBeacon technology in terms of near field communication or location, you know, knowing that I'm actually physically in the store, that I physically have my phone with me, those sorts of things, and it answers some of the sort of security problems. So I don't really see NFC as being the answer. The other thing several people have pointed out with NFC is that if you have two cards, say, in your wallet that are using the same system, there can be some crosstalk and some confusion, and you can even potentially get double charged because it won't know which card you actually want to use for the transaction. So it doesn't seem like the way to go, and I don't know why Apple would want to build it in unless they're going to build a standard just so that it can be used on other mobile payment platforms. I personally think, actually, these kind of technologies are not necessarily right for the phone. They seem to be more suited for something like the iWatch, of course, except the improved LTE. That would be part of the phone. But maybe Apple's looking at putting NFC and wireless charging, those sorts of things, into a watch or something that you're going to wear on your wrist, because you're more likely to always have that thing with you. You're also always going to have it out. So if you need to wave, if it is NFC and you need to wave it over a payment system, why not have it already there on your hand rather than having to reach into your pocket, actually pull out your phone and sort of wave it over the, you know, wave it over the sensor or whatever it might be. As far as the new LTE capabilities of the iPhone 6, they're saying that it's going to now have support for 300 megabit per second connections versus the 150 megabit per second capable radios that they're using right now. And screen size, of course, is one of the big rumors surrounding the iPhone 6. It's looking more and more like we're going to see two screen sizes, that is going to become the reality. Apple's expected to launch a 4.7-inch model first. Some say as early as September. I really think, though, everything's going to happen in October, but we'll have to wait and see on that. And then the 5.5-inch version of the iPhone 6 model following a few weeks to maybe even a few months later. It's been rumors they've been struggling with, you know, production on the larger size displays. As far as the 5.5-inch model goes, it's being widely rumored that it's going to come at a price premium, about $100 more than the 4.7-inch model. That makes sense to me. It's going to be a little bit more pricey to get the larger one. You can't have them priced both at the same price point. And a lot of analysts and folks are saying that the $100 price increase for the 5.5-inch model isn't going to be a problem in terms of sales for Apple, that many people are going to be happy to pay the extra premium to get the larger screen real estate. I don't know how you feel about it. I'm just hoping there's not going to be a lot of feature difference in terms of the two devices. If Apple goes off and puts better processors and better things in the 5.5-inch model, I'm going to be a little bit disappointed because I don't want the larger phone. I'm all for the 4.7-inch model. I think my current iPhone 5S is plenty large enough for me. I don't want them getting too much bigger. 5.5-inch feels like it's going to be a giant horse on my face or something like that. It's really, I think, too large. But I know a lot of people like that form factor, so I see why Apple might actually want to put out two versions of the device. What about you? Which device are you more interested in and planning on getting? And will you pay $100 more for the 5.5-inch model? As far as the glass and that's going on the screen, it's looking like sapphire is going to be the technology. I'm personally a bit concerned about how durable it's going to be in terms of breakage. It's pretty well known that sapphire is a little bit more susceptible to breaking than the current Gorilla Glass that Apple uses, but they've been working with GT Advanced Technologies. Maybe they have some new glass technology that they're going to wow us with in October at that October event. But as far as production goes, it looks like Apple's going to have plenty of sapphire glass on hand, at least according to a report published by Seeking Alpha. They say that GT Advanced Technologies has ramped up production enough to produce 200 million units annually, and they say that should be enough capacity to provide glass for displays on not just the 4.7-inch iPhone, but also the 5.5-inch iPhone 6 and have enough left over for iWatches and all the other stuff that Apple uses Sapphire for. So the lens covers for the cameras and also the Touch ID sensors. So if Apple is gone all in on Sapphire, they have gone completely all in, it sounds like. And then the design of the iPhone 6, we're starting to see more of that same design that we've been seeing. As a matter of fact, the same Weibo user in China, that's a Chinese blog, who posted accurate images of the iPhone 5 and the iPhone 5C before they were launched, has posted what is reported to be images of the first kind of assembled iPhone 6. And the design looks exactly like the mock-ups that we've been seeing. For me, unfortunately, because I really don't like those ugly end cap bands that sort of surround the metal end caps. I'm assuming those are there, and most people are assuming those are there for antenna transparency. I think they look really not good. They kind of break up the lines of the device, and I can't believe that Apple would have that in the design, but it might be because the ends now don't have the glass material where the camera lenses are or near the bottom of the phone. It looks like it's all metal, and so they're going to need a way for that antenna signal to actually get through. But these are reportedly the first fully assembled images, and they do show a thinner bezel around the screen. Also, a little less room at the top and bottom, so a little less room for the home button. Everything's kind of crammed together to kind of fit that screen in and not have the device get too much larger. And also, for some reason, the hole for the front camera appears to be much larger than on the current model. There are some rumors that the camera, the front-facing camera, might get a slight upgrade, so I don't know if that's, just a larger lens or a little bit better sensor. And further propping up this rumor, Sunny Dixon posted side-by-side mock-ups of the iPhone 6, both the 4.7 and the 5.5-inch model, although, some of the sites were reporting these as additional images of the upcoming iPhone 6. His images were mock-ups. They weren't the actual assembled thing like the user in China is reporting to have posted. So Apple is expected to announce the iPhone 6 in the fall, expected to be shipping sometime in October. And already component orders are going into place with suppliers. And the China Times is saying that orders are expected to exceed 100 million units. So Apple is really ready to launch a big new version of the iPhone. It's expected that this is going to be one of the biggest iPhone launches that we've seen in a while. A lot of people clamoring for the new larger sized screen. And not to be left out of the fray of new product announcements, we have a little bit of rumors surrounding the iPad Air and upcoming iPad minis. It's expected that component production on those is going to start this month, with some of the displays and processor and camera components are supposed to ramp up not much longer after that, sometime in the next month. Production is going to begin reportedly on the displays with LG Display in June, followed by Samsung and Sharp, ramping up production in the following months. As far as what the update's going to look like, it's being reported all of the sort of upgrades are going to happen internally, and the design is expected to remain mostly the same. It's also expected that display is probably not going to change. It's still going to be the 2048 by 1536 resolution, but the processor is expected to get a jump up to the A8 processor, which should bring some incremental performance increases and will be focused on increasing the efficiency and battery life of the iPad. The rear camera is also expected to get some improvements, moving from the 5-megapixel camera Apple's using right now up to an 8-megapixel camera, and the front-facing camera also might get a small bump, being jumped from 1.2 megapixels to 1.5 megapixels. As far as the iPad mini goes, it's expected to get similar style upgrades to the iPad Air. And then the one thing that I think we can almost all guarantee ourselves on is that both models, or all the models of the iPad, are going to get upgraded and feature Touch ID sensors on the home buttons. So that's all the latest updates in terms of hardware, or rumors on updates for hardware that I have for you this week. This next story I am somewhat excited about, because anybody who listens to this show knows that I'm not the hugest fan of the whole freemium app model. And it looks like Apple is not a huge fan of some of the shenanigans that have been going on in terms of trying to get people to promote and pay for their apps, some of the gaming of the systems that goes on when you're dealing with you know, the race to the bottom and trying to distinguish yourself as a freemium app. Apple has reportedly been rejecting apps that are incentivizing social sharing and ads as rewards for in-game purchases and things like that. So all those things where, hey, watch this video and you get some free credits, or hey, share this on Facebook, or ask your friend for help and we'll give you some free credits in the game. Specifically, Apple's citing two parts of the developer guidelines, 2.25 and 3.10. 2.25 actually restricts promoting of other apps from within your own app unless it's designed for a specific approved need. So if you have a health management app or an aviation app or some sort of accessibility app and it needs to interact with another application that you've partnered with, I guess there's some exceptions that can be called into play there. 3.10 says that you cannot manipulate App Store rankings, and that one seems a little bit vague, but I guess Apple seems to view the whole in-game rewards thing, probably specifically sharing out on social media for likes and coins or watching a video, as a violation of that policy. It's not really clear there, and Apple's never been really clear about their guidelines. They sort of just decide when they make the rules and things like that, which is where some of the frustration comes from developers. And I can definitely see that. But the gist of it is that developers can apparently no longer have the kind of more games or other games sections that point to other apps, basically ones that they don't own. It sounds like you're still going to be able to point to and promote your own apps from within your application, but there's been a lot of cross promotion, and I guess a lot of those ads involve that sort of cross promotion where, hey, watch this video for my partner's ad and then we'll give you some credits in this game. That stuff's going to have to go away. And all of those game rewards for social networking also seem to be getting caught in that net. So the whole Candy Crush, ask your friends for help sort of stuff, or whatever you do in that game. Honestly, I have to tell you, I've never played Candy Crush, although my wife is a really huge fan. But you're not going to be able to do that sort of stuff anymore. And I think that's actually a good thing, because it just becomes annoyance wear at that point, right? You're constantly having to annoy your friends to get further and further in the game. And I don't think that's something you want. I personally had used the sort of watch this ad feature to get in-game credits. I find it super annoying, but it was sort of an easy and non-intrusive way for me to get a little bit further in some of my games. But frankly, when that stuff comes up, eventually I get tired of it and end up just deleting the app, really. I'd really just prefer to buy my apps, and hopefully, you know, this is going to force more developers to look at that model in terms of selling their apps and making revenue, rather than all this sort of gaming and messing with their users to try and, you know, further other applications or you know, promote, cross-promote each other. One thing that this sort of cross-promotion, these cross-promotion techniques, even like them or not like them, do seem to point out is that Apple has an issue with, you know, getting the better apps better promoted in the App Store. And this week they did take a step to make that a little bit better over in Europe. They added more curation to the European App Store. Apple expanded the number of categories that are going to be curated by human editors to 12, adding 7 new categories to the 5 that were already being human curated in Europe. The other categories actually use algorithms to kind of promote and find more popular apps. And so, again, this is going to serve to kind of cut down on some of the gaming of the system. Developers have been using techniques and different kinds of things to kind of bump up apps, including posting false reviews. We also got a story this week that Apple is cracking down on those as well, and has been actually removing what it deems to be false reviews on new apps. So you'll have a new app hit the App Store and suddenly it'll have thousands of 5-star reviews. Apple is actually putting an end to that behavior. But that's a side note. Let's get back to the human curation and promoting of apps. The new sections are going to have the same custom layout that Apple's been using for curated categories in the U.S. App Store. So it's going to bring the European store more in line with the U.S. App Store. And these are all the things when you go into the App Store and you see the, I think the Apple's calling it the editor's choice, and you see all of these different featured sections where they're sort of put together categories and groupings of apps. Those are all hand-picked and curated by staff at Apple. So they're going to be doing that. So the new categories that they've added in Europe are productivity, photo and video, sports, music, lifestyle, health, and travel categories. They've all been updated and now show recommended and themed collections of apps when you go in there, and those are all done by Apple's editorial team. Games, kids, education, food, and newsstands were the categories that were already being human curated in Europe. So I think anytime that you can do that, you can have actual people review the apps, evaluate the quality, and then choose those for promotion. I think that's a much better system than just relying on some sort of mathematical algorithm. So hopefully that'll make finding and discovering the cooler apps a little bit more easy. And I've actually been enjoying a lot of those curated apps. I find a lot of my apps that way now when just generally browsing the App Store. It's helped a bit, but I think Apple still has a larger problem that they're going to have to address sometime in the future. And I think a lot of it comes into play because they sort of had to sardine can in apps and app sales and everything into iTunes. I think the root of the problem is at some point iTunes needs a giant, massive overhaul, or the iTunes store, rather. And whether that's breaking it up into smaller applications or what the actual solution, I don't really know is. But I do know there's sort of a point you get to where you can't just keep patching the thing that you already have. You have to kind of blow it away and start over. And Apple's actually really good at doing that. There's usually some pain in the transition, but you know, they've pulled it off with several of their applications. We're seeing it happen with the iWork applications right now, and those are getting much, much better. So Apple needs to take a sort of play from their own playbook and maybe do that with iTunes. Apple issued an update for MacBook Air owners, specifically owners of mid-2013 and early 2014 MacBook Airs. There's SMC Update 2.0. It addresses an issue that may cause the battery to drain faster than expected when the lid is closed. It also improves the reliability during booting and waking your computer while a USB or Thunderbolt device is connected, and solves an issue where a user's MacBook Air could fail to properly sleep the built-in display when an external monitor is connected while using Boot Camp. It also addressed a memory issue that might, in some cases, cause the system to randomly reboot. So if you've been suffering from any of those issues with your MacBook Air, or even if you haven't, you probably want to grab the SMC update. You can probably get it by running your software update utility or just going to apple.com/support. A story this week from 9to5Mac created a little bit of a flurry. They recently discovered a specification change that Apple made to its Made for I program that would allow for headphones that could use the Lightning connector rather than the standard 3.5mm jack. Now, this immediately caused a stir because a lot of people started speculating that Apple was getting set to remove the 13.5mm headphone jack from their devices sometime in the near future. It also could allow for higher quality lossless digital audio up to 48 kilohertz and digital headphones and things like that. So it makes sense for Apple to open up the specification. But the fact that Apple plans to replace the 3.5mm jack, I would say that's likely not going to happen, at least anytime soon. That thing's pretty ingrained and pretty standardized. A lot of us have headphones that use that jack, and for Apple to obsolete those, yes, they've done that sort of thing in the past, doing things like removing the floppy drive, but this seems to be a little bit bigger than that. You know, they could do dongles and things like that, but then you've got to buy a $29 dongle, and you may or may not always have it with you. You might not want to carry it around. You might have a set of travel headphones. You're not going to want to really replace all of your headphones with new ones with Lightning connectors. The licensing on the Lightning connectors are a lot more expensive. So while Apple is putting the specification in, I think it's just to have it there as more as an option, right? It's not going to be a replacement. But for example, Apple could develop now a new high definition pair of digital Beats headphones that could allow for higher quality audio, and you know, they could put out higher quality iTunes music in better formats, and audiophiles would actually love it, and they would pay a lot more, and they'd probably pay to get a special set of headphones so that they could hear the highest quality out there. I could see a case being made for getting rid of the 3.5mm jack if Apple wants to get their devices even thinner, because in my mind, that's currently the physical limiting factor for an iPhone to get any thinner. If you look at the side of your iPhone or your iPad Air, it's pretty much the exact depth of that 3.5 millimeter jack, maybe just a little bit more. I think we're somewhere around 4 millimeters, somewhere in that range. But you cannot get a lot smaller without actually replacing that jack. But I don't think Apple's ready to go that far yet. I think they're going to start to maybe get these newer headphones in the market. But unless Apple wants to open that up as a standard for other companies to use as a headphone jack, the Lightning connector, I don't see it replacing the 3.5 millimeter jack anytime soon. I think we spoke a little bit on the last episode about, or it might have been the prior episode, because I guess we talked about WWDC last time, but we spoke about the acquisition of Beats, Apple acquiring Beats Music and Beats headphones, and I discussed a little bit the fact that I think they're entering this phase where they've got kind of all the aspects of music covered in terms of having iTunes for purchases, having Beats Music now for the streaming service, and iTunes Radio to cover those of us who like services like Pandora and more of the traditional streaming radio service. Well, Apple expanded that service this week. They added, actually, ESPN Radio along with 40 local national public radio stations to their iTunes Radio service. So you can now tune in to NPR or ESPN. And they actually work more like, or exactly like, rather, the traditional radio stations. So you turn it on, and whatever programming happens to be on, as opposed to what iTunes Radio is for music, is sort of these pre-programmed playlists, right? You pick an artist, or you pick a genre, and you set up kind of your own little station, and then it plays that style of music. This time around, you're actually able to tune in to NPR or ESPN and just listen like you would as if you tuned it in on a terrestrial radio dial. So I fully expect that Apple's going to continue to expand services like this. It wouldn't really surprise me if one of the next things they're shooting for is maybe adding local radio stations to iTunes Radio so that you could actually pull up iTunes Radio and get your favorite local radio station content right there within Apple's app. And I think this is a good move, a good direction for them to be moving in. And I was excited to see them adding a couple of more traditional style radio stations to the service. Stop me if you heard this one. There's going to be new iMacs next week. It seems like that's a rumor that we just keep hearing over and over again. The trouble is, the new iMacs are always just a week away. The good news, though, is I can guarantee this rumor will eventually be right. This time around, though, they're saying that we might see new iMacs next week, although not the Retina IMAX some people were hoping for. It's looking to be a simple speed bump, bumping up the models about 100 megahertz, 0.1 gigahertz, if I'm doing my math right, in a processor bump, and that they would get updated Thunderbolt upgrading from the Thunderbolt 1 to Thunderbolt 2 ports, and possibly a price cut, so a little bit of a price drop on the next generation of IMAX. There are what appears to be some code references, actually, in OS X Mavericks 10.9.4. That's the next update, so the betas that are out to developers, that seem to indicate there could be some new iMac models on the horizon. Ming-Chi Kuo has also said he expects Apple to debut a low-cost iMac sometime this quarter, although it's not clear if that will be part of the batch of updates if they happen next week. And Apple is expected to announce the refresh later in the week, which is a bit odd. Normally, they would roll out new Mac models on Tuesday is kind of the typical day that they launch them, but it sounded like this time around it's going to be later in the week. So if you've been holding off on buying new iMac, you're going to want to wait toward the end of the week, see if they roll out something maybe Thursday or Friday, and it's going to be, the soft or quiet rollout that they do when they do these minor speed bumps. So just an update to the website sometime later in the week. If it doesn't happen this week, I'm sure we'll get rumors that it's coming the following week. But new iMacs, regardless, sometime soon. And if you live in Europe and you have an iPhone 3GS, iPhone 4, or iPhone 4S, you're going to want to listen to this story. Apple has announced that it will replace potentially dangerous 5-watt European USB power adapters that were shipped with the iPhone 3GS, iPhone 4, and iPhone 4S, as well as ones sold separately between October 2009 and September 2012. Apple has said that the USB adapters can overheat and pose a potential safety risk in rare cases. affected adapters are identified as model number A1300, so A1300, and the redesigned adapter is model A1400, and that one does not need to be replaced. So it's only the A1300 models. If you have one of those, you want to get a replacement, you can take your charger and your iPhone to an Apple retail store or a participating Apple authorized reseller. You do need to bring your iPhone because they need to verify the serial number in order to get the replacement. If you can't get to a store, they advise that you contact Apple's technical support to get details on how you can get an exchange. If you need to charge your iPhone in the meantime, they recommend that you connect it to your Mac with your USB cable to do your charging until you can get that charger replaced. So with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Since WWDC, I've been getting a lot of great feedback and comments and a lot of ideas. And I thought we'd kick things off and just share one of those comments with you. This one came from Cesar.
Hey, Adam, how you doing? This is a longtime listener from New York, Cesar. Thank you so much for the tips and podcasts of the years. I was just listening to your recent podcast on the Apple keynote, and Spotlight is king. It's great to see Apple finally like pushing the limit their classic apps. It's so frustrating to see all these different apps out in the market that pretty much do the same thing that Spotlight actually does, and other classic apps that Apple have. But I think it's going to be great for customers. I think in the future, it's going to be a much more simplified and unified area where they can just get information. Next to really tackle, it's going to be applications, the Launchpad, and the dock. That seriously needs to be simplified and just consolidated just for the average user. But, you know, it's a great start. And hopefully we'll see some new Apple products down the pipeline, specifically hardware. But I just want to thank you again for all the hard work and time you put in. Ciao from New York.
Hey, ciao, Cesar. Thank you so much for your comments. And I couldn't agree more about Spotlight and sort of the impact that that is going to have when it comes out and the change. I think consolidating all that information, making it sort of the one place to handle search, has a lot of implications. We talked about some of those on the last episode with how it's really challenging Google. Another thing is just bringing together services sort of under the Apple umbrella, whether they're Apple services or not. You know, there's going to be a lot of third-party data and services and stuff that plug into Spotlight, but really Spotlight's going to become the centralized search uniquely branded as Apple, and you're not really going to know at least immediately where the data, or maybe even care where the data is coming from, as long as it's the information you need. And I think that's really, really powerful. That's a big, big change that's going to happen. I'm also very interested in your comments about the dock and Launchpad, because I don't actually think about those all too much. I mean, the dock is just kind of there. It's always been the dock. Sort of the place where, at least for me, I throw some of my most frequently used applications. And maybe it's the thing that indicates where I can kind of see what apps are running if I want to, you know, maybe shut some down that I'm not currently working with. The Launchpad is one of those things that I think I've never really used, and I don't know that many people who actually do use it. So I'd be, one, curious to hear from folks who think that the Launchpad is, you know, something that's really critical to the operating system or that they use day to day. But I really use Safari as my application launcher most of the time. And as far as the dock goes, it's serves its utility. But I'm curious to get your take on where you think improvements or sort of enhancements need to come into play, or maybe just even replacing those sorts of tools with other things. What kinds of things are you thinking about would supplement the dock and the launch pad and stuff like that? I haven't given much thought to this, so now I'm really curious. And anyone who wants to chime in, you know, shoot us a comment or email. But again, Cesar, thank you so much for the feedback from what happened at WWDC. And I think most of us agree it's going to be some exciting times when OS X Yosemite and iOS 8 get out on the market and get in the hands of the general public. But so far, it's been very, very exciting. Next, I want to comment on several conversations I guess I've had over the years about upgrading older Macs. And this topic has kind of come back into the front of my mind because of recent issues I had with my MacBook Pro. Those of you who listen to the show know that I had some issues, had to send it in for service for some service, get a logic board replaced, and as part of that process, they identified my RAM upgrade as being faulty and saying that I needed some new RAM. They replaced my RAM with original Apple RAM, dropping me from 8 gigabytes back down to 4 gigabytes of RAM in my MacBook Pro. Luckily, they sent the RAM back from service, and it's Crucial RAM, which is guaranteed for life. One of my favorite brands of memory to buy, and they went ahead and did a warranty replacement for me. So I have my new 8-gigabyte upgrade kit back, but I haven't installed it yet. I will install it, but I haven't installed it yet. And I have often been a big proponent of RAM as a really affordable upgrade that you can do on an older Mac to give it a little more life. And I actually still stand behind that. I know this is controversial with some of you, but what I've always argued is that a RAM upgrade sort of gives you a really good bang for the buck. RAM upgrades are pretty cheap. I think the 8-gigabyte upgrade for my MacBook Pro is under $100. And jumping from 4 to 8 can be a significant improvement, especially in OS X Mavericks, which it seems like, because I tried running it with 4 gigabytes and a spindle drive, it was a bit rough going, I have to admit. You know, so having 8, I never really had a problem, even though I had the spindle drive. Now, there's many of you who have argued that the best upgrade you can do now is replacing your spinning hard drive with an SSD, and I've never disputed that as well. I know that you can get a lot of workflow efficiency with an SSD upgrade, because booting your computer, shutting down your computer, launching applications, all those sorts of processes happen much, much quicker with a solid-state drive in your Mac. But the reason I've always held off on recommending that as a cost-effective upgrade is because SSDs on a per megabyte, you know, price point had been really expensive. I mean, even up until recently, although now prices are starting to come down very, very quickly. And that's why I'm not necessarily changing my opinion, but I'm saying an SSD upgrade, if you're thinking about an upgrade for an older Mac, is really worth looking into. It's still going to cost you a little bit more than just a RAM upgrade, but if you take what you might have spent on a RAM upgrade and apply that toward an SSD, you might see that it's even a little bit more affordable. And I'm really talking about SSDs that are matching the storage sizes of the spinning drive that might be in your older Mac. And that was another kind of key factor for me, because I had a 500 gigabyte drive in my MacBook Pro, and I really didn't want to jump down to like a 256. So I probably could have picked one of those up, and it would have been a little more cost effective for me. But I really wanted 500 gigabytes of storage. So what happened is after my Mac went in, I thought, you know, maybe it's time to look at SSDs again. And a couple people had said the prices had come way down. And I found on Amazon a Crucial M500 480 gigabyte drive for around $215 US. So that's getting down into that 50 cents a megabyte range, which is really affordable. I mean, that is a good price for an SSD upgrade. So I went ahead and ordered it. I also got the OWC data doubler. That's the thing that would allow me to take my spinning drive and put it in place of my optical drive, my super drive in my MacBook Pro, which I never ever use or hardly ever use. I guess I use it when I rip my DVDs to get them into my collection. But I also then just went ahead and got the OWC Super Slim case for the Apple SuperDrive, so an external USB enclosure. And I went through the whole process of installing, taking out the old drive, moving it over into the data doubler, installing the new SSD drive, which I actually went ahead and cloned first. So I did a super duper clone from my internal drive onto the SSD, then installed it in my Mac, moved the spinning drive over, pulled the DVD drive out, and put that in the enclosure. And for all of that, I used the iFixit app with its install instructions, which are just phenomenal. Normally, I would use the iFixit website, but they now have an app. And that made it really easy to have my iPad right next to me as I was doing my upgrade. So I really recommend you take a look at that if you're doing upgrades and repairs on older Macs. I also highly recommend the iFixit Pro Tech Toolkit. I purchased one a long time ago, but they're now just $64.95 on the iFixit website. And it has every possible tool, spludger, bit. It's got their 54-bit set. It's got a whole set of spludgers, both metal and plastic. So these are for getting at the little cables, making sure that you don't break anything. It's got the anti-static strap in there. It's got suction cups if you need to get into an iPhone or the iMac where you have to go in through the screen. Basically all the tools, and it's got it in a really nice case. So take a look at that. But after doing the SSD upgrade, I have to say it's totally held up to everything everybody's told me. The speed difference is phenomenal. And getting back to that 8 gigabyte memory upgrade, I've been actually running with 4 gigabytes of RAM with the SSD on Mac on OS X Mavericks, really without issue. It's actually performing better than when I just had the 8 gigabytes. Now, I have not used the trim enabler, which a lot of people, there's this whole debate about, do you need trim or do you not need trim? It's really, really heated, and I can't really get a straight answer one way or another, so I'm still kind of doing a little bit of research on that, and I expect fully now that I'm going to get email from both sides of the camp, so send in your arguments why I should use trim enabler, why I should not use trim enabler, but big thumbs up on SSD upgrades. And like I said, they're getting, the prices are coming way down, and you can get about 50 cents a megabyte on your SSD upgrades. But I also still stand behind the memory upgrade. I'm going to put that 8 gigabytes back in because I did go in and look at my activity monitor, and I'm definitely going to swap much more frequently, moving into the virtual memory space. The difference now though is, of course, it's going to a solid state drive, so you really don't notice the performance impact as much, but I'd still much prefer to have RAM tasks handled by RAM and leave the disk tasks, the IO tasks, to the disk drive. So going to do that upgrade, but I just wanted to mention that because it's a little bit of a change in sort of how I've been recommending things. And again, I was unaware that prices had come down so much on SSDs. And so if you hadn't looked in a while, it might be worth taking a look again. And speaking of SSDs, I believe that this next story is one of the most amazing and strange stories I've heard since doing the MacCast. And I've heard some strange things, but this one feels like it's something almost out of a spy film. Received an email from Ollie, and he was on holiday and had his MacBook Pro with him. And he said he went out for the day, and when he did, he hid it in his hotel room in a cabinet or something like that. Returned from dinner and decided he wanted to do a little bit of work. And so he got the Mac out, and it wouldn't boot up. He just got the gray screen or the folder with the little question mark, you know, looking like the operating system was missing or something was wrong with the drive. And he, too, had recently upgraded to a Crucial SSD. And he thought that might be the issue because he had heard about some people having some issues. He called Crucial support. They walked him through some standard troubleshooting things, but then said one of the final tricks he could try would involve connecting and disconnecting, or disconnecting and reconnecting the hard drive. But he didn't have the tools with him at the time because he was on vacation, and so he decided that he'd wait till he got home. Well, when he got home, he opened up the Mac and found that it had a 500 gigabyte Hitachi spinning drive in it and not his upgraded Crucial SSD. So it was like thieves had broke in, but they didn't just take the whole MacBook Pro. They went in, completely opened it up, stole his hard drive, and not only that, you'd think they'd just take it out and, you know, leave the hole, close it back up, none the wiser. No, they put in a different spindle drive that was apparently blank and formatted for Mac. I guess that was kind of courteous, right? The assumption here is that somehow they took the drive for the data, so I might have to email Ollie back, or Ollie, if you're listening, are you in the kind of business where it might be an industrial espionage kind of thing where they want to get access to some of your research or your data projects that maybe you're working on, or maybe you're a spy and it's just real espionage? I have no idea, but really getting the point, Ollie wanted to know, you know, what could the thieves have access to on his drives? He mentioned there are four accounts on the drive, including a guest account. The three accounts actually have passwords set. The guest account does not. And unfortunately, though, he did admit to me that the three user accounts didn't have incredibly secure passwords. And so I think, you know, there's not too much a thief could do without the passwords, assuming that you don't have the Macs. I'm assuming you don't have the Mac here set to auto log in on one of those accounts on boot up. Obviously, if it's going to auto log in, then they're going to have access to a lot of stuff. But in terms of getting access to your files and emails and stuff like that, they're going to have to go in and try and crack those passwords. Now, if the passwords are real easy, simple passwords, something that are maybe common dictionary words or maybe even common words where you're using the little tricks like 3 for the letter E, you know, all those ones that we know, and a 1 for an I or an L, you know, replacement, that sort of stuff, then it really wouldn't take somebody who really wanted to get in there too long to crack that. And unfortunately, there's not much you can do to protect the data after the fact. So I think you're kind of out of luck. If they want to get at that data and they want to try and crack your passwords, they probably will. My guess, I guess if that's their whole end game, there might be some incentive for them to do that. It's just the whole story to me is odd. It's because, like, I would have just thought they would break in and just take the whole computer. You know, why leave the computer? And then even more, why replace the hard drive for you? It's just, I'm still a little bit baffled by that one. But, you know, really, you have to think about data protection in advance. And key number one, I'm sure you know this, is to use a really strong password. A trick that I started using recently is just picking 4 of my favorite books and then taking the first word in the title of each book and stringing those together as a password, and then just insert a number and a symbol somewhere within that whole hash, right? So these are 4 non-connected regular words, but strung together and then strung together with numbers and special characters. Makes it pretty easy to remember your 4 favorite books, and maybe you pick a pound sign and the number 7, right? And you put that in the third and last slot or the second and, you know, whatever combination seems to work for you. And that seems to be a pretty easy way to get a good strong password. Of course, I also just use the technique of having an application like 1Password generate and remember a really strong password for me. So if you get your Mac up and running, you get a new SSD drive, make sure you're doing that. Another thing you can do if you're really concerned about data from something, you know, being taken from something like a hard drive theft or something like that, you can consider enabling File Vault 2, which is Apple's built-in whole disk encryption. Again, real easy to do. Just go into the system preferences, turn on File Vault, and now you'll have all of your information encrypted. If someone were able to crack your password, the password is the key to getting into your desktop, and the data would then be available and accessible. So number 1 and number 2, strong password and File Vault, kind of need to work hand in hand together. Another technique that you could use is you could use encrypted disk images, just build them with Disk Utility. You know, go into Disk Utility, create a disk image and encrypt it. And you can use that to just store individual sensitive files and things like that. That'll help better protect your data. But again, that doesn't help if they cracked your password, because your password is going to be the thing that's going to allow access to the encrypted disk image. I think probably the best thing if you're traveling is, if at all possible, either take the laptop with you if you're going to be going out, or lock the laptop in a hotel room safe. I do that very frequently when I'm traveling. If there's a room safe, I usually can fit my 15-inch MacBook Pro, my iPad Air, and any iPods or additional, you know, kind of valuable accessories and things like that that I might have with me, no problem. And you could also ask at the front desk if there is just a hotel safe that you could use, something that you could put down there. And I know that doesn't help now, but just something to think about for the future. But, you know, anytime somebody has physical access to your stuff, it's sort of like all bets are off. You know, had the whole computer been taken and you use something like Find My Mac, you could even initiate a remote wipe sort of scenario which would be a good thing. But, you know, that's not going to be an option if they just steal the hard drive. And maybe that's another reason why they just took the drive and didn't take the whole computer. Really don't know. But I hope you've been able to get everything back and back up and running. Hopefully you had backups and those sorts of things. But I really appreciate you sharing and sort of asking the questions. But just a very, very strange, bizarre story. And I guess maybe because of that, have you had this happen to you where you had just the hard drive stolen and not anything else? The main thing I can think of is to perpetrate identity theft. But, you know, if the hard drive is locked or password protected, you'd think they'd check that before they just took the drive. Or maybe that's just too much time. I don't know. It just still seems like too much time to just swap out the drive. Seems like it would take way too long. And you just want to grab the computer and run. I really don't know. And something else I really don't know about, or am often confused by, I guess, is the more accurate way to say this, is time zones. In podcasting, I'll often have a situation where I'm trying to schedule an interview with someone or just a podcast with like a round table of folks. And you have people in different time zones and different countries and things like that. And just coordinating like what time and are we on daylight savings time and all that stuff can be a little bit confusing. And Carlos emailed me to express some frustration with dated reminders in the Reminders app, because Carlos often travels between time zones and has set reminders to be at specific dates and times, but noticed that as he would move time zones, the reminders would actually shift accordingly. So in some cases, this meant that a reminder would go off later than he would have expected. And this happens if your iOS device has been set up to set the time zone automatically based on your location. So as you're traveling, your time zone's going to automatically change in the date and time, and then your reminders all shift accordingly. So normally, this is probably what you want. It's actually, I would think, expected behavior, but there are, I think, some cases, and this is where Carlos was expressing frustration, there are some cases where you don't want that to happen. So the classic scenario is, you set a reminder, call Bob at 3 p.m., and you set it in, say, the Pacific time zone, right? And then you move to New York on the East Coast, it's going to get shifted to 6 p.m., but because it goes off at 6 p.m. New York time, it's still going to be 3 p.m. Pacific time, so you're going to call Bob at the right time, right? That's how it's working right now. But some events you might not want adjusted, I don't think, in the same way. You might want them to stay the same regardless of time zone, and that would be something like, say you need to take some medication, for example, and you want to take that pill at 8 a.m. each day, right? So you set up a recurring reminder. You say, at 8 a.m., remind me to take my pill. And now you've traveled from, say, the Pacific time zone to New York. So you're 3 hours ahead. Well, now your reminder's going to get shifted till 11. That means when you wake up in New York the next morning, it's not going to remind you at 8 a.m. It's going to remind you at 11 a.m., which may or may not be the desired result. So basically, the problem is that reminders don't have time zone support in iOS. I don't think or on the Mac. And time zone support, for those of you who don't know, is a feature in the calendar app that lets you enter events in the time zone that they will happen in. And then when you travel between time zones, they'll be adjusted accordingly. So they'll always be adjusted for whatever time zone you're currently in. And that feature is normally on by default in OS X and in iOS. If you want to check the setting, you can go in OS X into Calendar Preferences, click on Advanced, and then you'll see a checkbox for turning on time zone support. In iOS, you'll find the setting in Settings, Mail, Contacts, and Calendars. You need to scroll down to the Calendars Settings section and then tap on Time Zone Support. And when enabled, time zone support gives you an extra little drop-down menu when you're entering an event, and you can set the time zone that that event is going to be in, and then it will be adjusted accordingly. So if you set up a meeting, say, or an event for 12 p.m. Pacific time, and then you move to the Eastern time zone, that event is going to go off in the calendar at 3 p.m. Eastern time. But there's also this extra feature called a floating time zone. And when you set the time zone to floating, that means it's always going to keep the event at that time, regardless of the time zone that you're in. So even though everything else will adjust, any floating calendar events will stay fixed to that time. So that works in that scenario where I want to take a pill at 8 a.m. If you set that up as a calendar event, then you would be reminded at 8 a.m. regardless of which time zone that you were in. So for you, Carlos, I think maybe there are a few workarounds or things that you might be able to do so that you can have your reminder happen and be always at the same time, regardless of time zone. One thing that you could do is you could turn off the auto setting for setting your time zone based on location. So if you go into iOS settings, general, date and time, you can turn off the set automatically option. On the Mac, you'll go into system preferences, date and time. And then in the date and time tab, you want to uncheck the set date and time automatically option. When you do that, then as you're moving time zones, your iOS device isn't going to change. So then your reminders are going to happen exactly when you want them to happen. At that exact time. Now, that's not going to be ideal for most people because usually you want to have your time reflecting the current time zone that you're in. So another option that I thought is you could just enter your reminder in the calendar application with time zone support enabled and then use that floating time zone option. So, you know, set your reminder for 8 a.m. to 8:05, you know, maybe a 5-minute window, and just have it go off using that little floating window, and then it'll never change. Another option is you could just simply switch to using some third-party to-do app that doesn't get adjusted for time in the same way that Apple's Reminders app does. So a few things that I can think of. If you have some other technique for sort of managing this that you can share with us and Carlos, please shoot me an email. maccast@gmail.com. But I thought that was interesting. I really think ultimately it'd be great if Apple would just bring the time zone support into reminders so you can set a reminder, either assign it a time zone or assign it a floating so that it always happens at the same time every day. And I think that would be probably the best solution. And probably something worth actually, Carlos, if you're interested in it, giving Apple feedback on. So if you go to apple.com/feedback, you could give that that recommendation to them, and hopefully they would add it in a future update of the operating system. Glenn wrote me recently to say that he is battling the forces of darkness on his Mac, or at least he's fighting with memory issues that he calls memory vampires. Glenn noticed recently that after quitting several applications, the memory in his system didn't appear to free up, and he calls that process memory vampire, sort of sucking the memory out of his Mac. And he wanted to know about using applications like Memory Clean, which allow you to go in and sort of manually scrub and increase the amount of free memory that's available to your system. And I think, Glenn, to answer your question, we first need to understand how OS X uses memory, or more the different kinds of memory that it tracks. And I've talked about this in the past, but a quick little review. You've got free memory, wired memory, active memory, inactive memory, and used memory. And free memory is pretty straightforward. It's the amount of RAM that's not being used. Wired memory is a little bit harder to understand. It's actually information that's in RAM that can't be swapped out or moved out into a virtual disk. So it's kind of hardwired. It has to use the physical RAM that's in your system. Active RAM, that's the information that's currently in RAM and is being used, so actually used RAM. And then you have this inactive memory, kind of the vampire memory that you're talking about. This is information that's in RAM, but it's not actively being used by an application, although it was used recently. And then used RAM is the total amount of RAM that's being used. So that's going to be your wired plus your active plus your inactive. So when you're looking at that, you know, sort of total used feature, all those things are rolled up and encompassed in that. And you used to be able to see the stats for free, wired, active, inactive, and used memory in the activity monitor prior to OS X Mavericks. In OS X Mavericks, they changed things a little bit. they took the actual numbers away that you could see in the stats in Activity Monitor and replaced it with something they're calling memory pressure. It's a little graph that's in the middle of the stats, and it has some colors that get applied to it. And so if you go into Activity Monitor, you're looking at the memory pressure. If it's green, it means that there are enough resources available based on the amount of RAM that you have. If it's amber, it's noting that the resources are getting taxed, the memory resources are starting to get taxed. And if you see it in red, that means that you're totally out of RAM and you probably want to go in and quit some applications and free up some memory, because OS X is actually using all of the available memory that you have. And tools like Memory Cleaner, basically what they do is they force this purging of that inactive memory. So that's what you're seeing when you quit an application and you don't see the memory numbers changing in the Activity Monitor. They're not changing because that inactive memory is still considered to be in-use memory or used memory, and it's not part of that whole free memory thing. So Memory Cleaner is going to allow you to go in and sort of mark that stuff and say, okay, purge that out of there, purge that inactive, and make it available as free memory to my applications. And that may or may not be a good thing, depending upon what your intent is, because inactive memory is sitting there and available to applications should they need it. So it's not really quote-unquote used. It's just kind of hanging around. You can think of it a lot like when you erase a file on your hard drive, right? It doesn't actually get deleted. Those bits just get marked to say, you know what, I don't need this stuff anymore. If you need to overwrite it, you can come along and overwrite it. Same kind of thing with the memory. It's like, here's some memory. I was using it. I'm not using it anymore. I haven't purged out the data and information that's in there. But if you need it, go ahead and take it and write whatever you want into it. And the reason you might want that to go on is that, say you want to reopen a document or reopen an application that you recently quit. Well, guess what? If it's sitting still around in inactive memory, nothing else has needed it, it can pull that stuff out of RAM again rather than having to spin up the disk and write all kinds of stuff back into memory. So you do get kind of a caching, little bit of speed improvement. And you can actually see this on your Mac. If you go and you launch an application, watch how long it takes to actually boot up that app. Then immediately quit the application, go ahead and relaunch it again, and what you're going to find is that second launch is typically seconds faster. I mean, it moves quite a bit faster, and the reason is because it's already loaded a lot of stuff into RAM. Even though you quit it, it said, okay, that's inactive, but it's sitting around. Now you've relaunched the app, it can go in and gain all that stuff back. Now, in Glenn's case, the issue was he's using Final Cut and Motion, and it would slow down his iMac that had 4 gigabytes of RAM. He noticed that even when he boot up the Mac with no apps running at all and looked at the memory, it would show 3 gigabytes in use with just 1 gigabyte of RAM free. And he found out that using an app like Memory Cleaner would allow him to get a little more free RAM and could improve his performance when he was using Final Cut and Motion for about 20 minutes, and then it would kind of slow down again, and then I think you'd have to go through this whole, you know, purge the free RAM sort of cycle sort of thing, and you could kind of get working a little bit. You know, with memory-intensive apps, I guess that you might get some benefits from doing this little memory cleanup, but Glenn, as you noted, it's sort of this temporary little boost to your speed. And so I really think in this case, because you're running some heavy-duty applications like Final Cut and Motion, it's a case where you just don't have enough physical RAM. 4 gigabytes of RAM is probably not enough to be running those apps. Again, as I noted with, you know, when I had my spindle drive, I think running OS X Mavericks with 4 gigs of RAM is barely enough. I really think you need a minimum of 8. So I would consider a memory upgrade. And, you know, it's really easy to look at that memory pressure figure and also look at the swap used number in the Activity Monitor to kind of determine if you're using a lot of virtual memory. If it's having to write out to disk a lot, then that's a good indication that you might want to think about upgrading your physical RAM to get a little bit more performance. As I noted earlier, another thing you might try is just upgrading to an SSD drive. That's going to make where it's having to page out and write to the disk little less impactful in terms of seeing beach balls and those sorts of things. And again, I think memory intensive applications like Photoshop and probably Final Cut and Motion also do a lot of their own disk caching or writing out disk of information and stuff like that. So that could be also part of the slowdown. But, you know, memory cleaner is not going to hurt anything. So if you just feel better knowing that the free memory is purged and there, just note that if you do use a tool like that, you're going to lose that cached ability when you're sort of relaunching an application, and it won't be able to pull those resources back out of RAM because you've actually, you know, told it manually, hey, get rid of all that stuff. And finally, for today, I am going to share with you a little tip. If you have an older Airport Express, and I would assume also an Airport Extreme base station, and you're running OS X Mavericks, you may have run into this issue where you realize you don't have a tool to actually manage and configure your airport anymore. I have an older 802.11 G Airport Express base station that I actually use as a AirPlay speaker system in here in my office. And the trouble is that Apple's Airport Utility version 6.3 will not let you, and that's the version that runs on Mavericks, that will not let you configure the older model airports. You have to use version 5.6.1, or I think there's a 5.6 version. There's different versions depending upon which version of the operating system you're running. But you definitely, with Airport Utility 6.3, you cannot use that to configure these older base stations. So in my case, I have to use Airport version 5.6.1. Well, guess what, though? 5.6.1 will not run in OS X Mavericks. So you have this dilemma where OS X Mavericks, the airport utility that will run it, will not configure the airport, yet the tool that can configure that airport will not run in OS X Mavericks. And one potential solution to that is, well, get an older Mac running an older version of the operating system and you can run the old airport utility. But having a whole dedicated Mac just to configure your aging airport is probably not the thing that you want to do. 5.6.1 is available for download on Apple's support website, but you cannot run it out of the box. Luckily, though, there is a hack around from developer Corey Mailer, and I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But what basically Corey has put together is a little second launcher application that you put into a folder along with the airport utility 5.6.1, the older version of the app. You put those both together in a folder in the applications folder on your OS X Mavericks system, and then you launch the launcher, which will then launch airport utility and allow it to run on OS X Mavericks. So that really solved the problem. It looks like what it does is it adds in some of the needed libraries to be able to launch the 5.6.1 version on an OS X Mavericks Mac. And you need to use the launcher each time that you need to run the airport utility. So you need to keep the two apps and you just run that as the launcher instead of double-clicking on airport utility itself. And I have to say it works beautifully. It runs just fine under OS X Mavericks, which to me is just a little bit frustrating because obviously Apple could make this work relatively easily. I'm not really sure why. Well, I can take that back. We can all guess why they are not allowing you to configure older airports on newer versions of the operating system. They want you to buy a new airport, right? That's got to be the end game. That seems to be the only reason that you would actually do this. But one other thing to note is the launcher application from Corey is not a signed app. So the first time you need to run the launcher, you will need to control click on it and use the control click open trick. It'll ask you to verify that you want to launch the application. Click OK, and then you'll be done. From that point forward, you can always launch the application. But because of Apple's gatekeeper technology, an app that's not signed, you have to kind of implicitly say, yes, I do want to run this app. And you'll need to do this with the little airport launcher. But I was really happy to find this tool, and it means that I'm going to be able to continue to use my older base station, and I'm not going to have to pay Apple another $80 for a new one that I really don't need, because this one works just fine. So last little tip for you for today, but with that, that is going to do it. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, and Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, and also check out PDF Pen Scan Plus for your iOS devices. You can get more information and details on all of their software over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle is the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, and other Apple products are worth simply by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. You can get a free trial simply by going to lynda.com/Maccast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. I also want to thank a few other supporters. Bandwidth for the Maccast is provided by CashFly at cashfly.com, and all advertising on the Maccast is handled by Backbeat Media at backbeatmedia.com. Big thank you to you for your support and staying subscribed. If you have a comment or a question for me, want to shoot me an audio comment, you can send email to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline and leave a voicemail. That number is 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. And if you need show notes with links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you'll find those on the website. That's at maccast.com. And while you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And between shows, you can follow me on Twitter.com/MacCast. You can also check out the Facebook page over at facebook.com/TheMacCast, or check out the Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus. And with that, that is going to do it for this episode. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.